The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're looking at two recent science stories, ones that have caused some controversy in the media and online. In just a bit, we're joined by genetics researcher Michael White to talk about the slightly exaggerated conclusions of a big new study of the human genome. But first, let's look at the widely criticized neuroscience in a new book about female sexuality. I'm here with David Dobbs, writer at Neuron Culture on Wired.com and author of Reef Madness and My Mother's Lover. Wonderful to have you back, sir.
Nice to be here.
So, full disclosure, I have not read the book Vagina by Naomi Wolf, but I have read your reviews about it. And so, maybe just tell us what the book is about besides the obvious. Besides the vagina.
Well, the book, Naomi Wolf sets out to write to convince us of a vision of female sexuality and identity that is centered around vagina. There's sort of no getting around it. I mean, she comes right out and says this, and it stems from an episode that is one can have sympathy for, where she started in her mid to late 40s. Her sexual satisfaction dropped off. She just wasn't enjoying it like she was before, and went and found out that apparently she had a pinched nerve that was cutting off nerve sensation coming from her whole pelvic area. So this explained the problem. They fixed it surgically, and then she was thrilled that everything came back. But this convinced her, because of the science that was involved, a lot of science that she thought was involved, that she needed to rethink female sexual response, and was very eager to share what she learned and her new vision of female sexuality and even consciousness with the rest of the world. So this book is her sharing that, and you can have a basic sympathy with her mission, I think, but still take extreme exception to how she tries to harness science to make her argument.
Right. And so the majority of her book, I guess, it seems to be centered around the more personal or philosophical topics, but we are not here to talk about that stuff. I'd like to talk about the neurological studies that she wrote about, which conveniently are what your reviews focused on. So to give everyone an idea of where we're going with this, fill in the blank for me, if you could. The neurological studies that Naomi Wolf refers to as evidence for a revolutionary new understanding of the brain-vagina connection are?
carefully selected, it seems. They're not representative of the broader literature on this, which is very mixed. Some things she just gets outright wrong, other things she overextends. She draws a lot from the work of a Dr. Jim Faust, who's up at Concordia University in Montreal. And his work, some people take real exception to, but she even stretches the meaning and significance of his work in the service of, you know, her particular vision. It's one of these things, you know, in my Reef Madness book, it was about a long argument about coral reefs, and one insult that was tossed about during this long argument during the 19th century, I can't remember who said it or who they were referring to, but they said, referred to a book that this person wrote about coral reefs, and it said it contained all the facts that the author could possibly collect that supported his argument. And this seems to be the problem with Naomi Wolf's book here, is that the science she harnesses mainly in the first quarter of the book, it's sprinkled throughout, but that's where the science is kind of front-loaded. Most of it is either really a weak sampling of a lot of broad things, or she just plain gets wrong. Now, there is, you know, it starts in a way sort of promising, at least in a relative way. So when she's explaining her medical problem, she describes going to the one of the several doctors she went to and how he explained to her that this was a wiring problem. You know, it was a nerve problem, and that the nerve, the innervation of the female pelvis and everything that had anything to do with sex was very complicated, and that every woman is wired differently, and that so, therefore what brings them sexual pleasure varies tremendously. And she was, she, as she described, she said she almost fell off the edge of the exam table in her astonishment. And if I can quote her, that's what explained vaginal versus clitoral orgasms, neural wiring, not culture, not upbringing, not patriarchy, not feminism, not Freud, and so on. Now, in a way, this is a very helpful thing to know.
Right.
She likes knowing it, and it does have the virtue of sort of hopefully clarifying this long argument over whence orgasms come and making the important point that people vary in how they respond to different, you know, what makes them, what's pleasurable, which is not a big surprise. So that much is encouraging. And I think it would have been a pretty good book if she just stopped right there, because from there she goes on into the dopamine well, and then the oxytocin well, and the serotonin well, and she falls right into all of them and gets most of them badly wrong, and I think even more fatally represents them as being of a simplicity and certainty that isn't justified by the state of the science.
And you actually have a bit of a vested interest in getting these kinds of things right. You're writing a book on evolutionary psychology and genes and such.
I am. And so I think part of why this book irked me is that, you know, I'm a year late with my book right now because this stuff is really, really complicated. Now, I'm not writing about the same thing she's writing about, but I'm writing about how essentially how genes and neurotransmitters help shape behavior and temperament. So it's, you know, a roughly parallel thing. And if you're writing about these things right now, the thing you understand, and you're, you know, you're focusing and you're open-minded and you listen to skeptics, the thing that strikes you is that this is a field in enormous flux. And that's on the genetic side. And on the neuroscientific side, also an enormous flux, because the linkage between the genetics that generate these neurotransmitter systems and inform how they work and neuroscience is quite tight. They're just one washes over the other. Neuroscience, meanwhile, is, you know, we've been doing it for 100 years, but it's really a field, if not in its infancy, certainly in its childhood or youth. Almost a year ago, I was at the neuroscience meeting, this massive meeting where all the neuroscientists from all over the world come, and talking to a lot of people. I go to that most every year. And I was at a table, and it struck me to ask around the table, it was a big table full of neuroscientists, if 100 is this, is knowledge that we understand at an operating level, almost virtually everything we need to know to understand the brain and everything that flows into and from it. If that's 100, where are we now in our progress towards 100? And almost all the answers were in the single digits, between 5 and 10. And a few wandered up timidly, sort of apologetically, into the teens. So this is how early we are in neuroscience. Now, some areas are more advanced than others, but it's, it is not a field that offers many places to stand and say, this we know, this we can act on with certainty, and therefore this we should constantly write what amounts to a manifesto for a new vision of human sexuality.
So then are you saying that maybe you might be facing similar types of critiques of your work at some point?
Well, it depends on what I want to do. In one of the pieces I wrote in response to this, I took exception. I wasn't the only one who kind of called this neuroscience as self-help. And I think this is the problem, is that there's too much science writing that succumbs to this, what Ta-Nehisi Coates called the oracle problem, where we have to have the final answers and we want them now. And because we're discovering really amazing things, really cool dynamics at a fairly rapid pace in neuroscience, it can give the illusion that we actually understand everything. Where the real science, you know, if you're finding like something really cool and new really often, what this means is you're just getting started. Because if it was a really mature science and you knew most of what you needed to know, you wouldn't really be finding that many new things out. So the very, you know, plentifulness of the cool stuff we're finding is actually cause for humility, not overconfidence. And I'd like to see people write about science in general recognizing that more, that science is always provisional. And when you're writing about progress, you're writing about a movement from one stone to another in a path of stones that you can't see the far end of, instead of writing as if, we have the answer. This is how this mechanism works. This is why we behave in exactly this way. This is why we respond the way we do. This is how women, all women, or almost all women, respond to desire, generate desire, and get satisfaction. And here, therefore, are the kind of political and cultural implications of it. I think the rock that Naomi Wolf is standing on, she doesn't realize how slippery it is. And she thinks it's a towel and broadcasts accordingly. But it just doesn't justify it. I think we need to think in different ways about how we write about, report about science and emphasis. I mean, some people do, but there's too much of this where it's the answer. It's how we do this, or the reason. It's how, why, it's the answer, instead of looking at kind of where we are in the path, and that leaving the reader knowing something new, but recognizing that it's a step along the way, and that while it improved maybe on what came before, it will be improved on and needs to be improved on. It's an imperfect state of knowledge, especially when we're this early in a field.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest is David Dobbs, writer at Wired.com. David and I are discussing his reviews of the neuroscience in Naomi Wolf's new book, Vagina. So let's talk about some of the details. Wolf describes dopamine as the ultimate feminist chemical. So what does she mean by that?
She makes a claim that... Well, I'll try to make it as simple as I can. There's kind of two claims. One is that dopamine is what is its key in motivation and desire, which it is, but she treats it as being especially about sexual motive, desire and satisfaction. And that, by her account, it's more important to women than it is to men. She makes the same argument about oxytocin, that these are, feminist chemicals, because they are the thing that drives a sexuality in women that is particularly dependent on a broad sort of whole, not just whole organism response, but on being cultivated as and charmed and courted in a really extensive way, which may be true for some people, but isn't true for others. But her problem with the dopamine is that, first of all, she seems to see it as purely about reward, about paying off, about the payoff in a reward. And dopamine, it's probably really more accurate to say that it's about the anticipation of reward. This is what dopamine, it creates desire. It creates the want for something. And she makes a lot of blanket statements like a woman who is low in dopamine will have a low libido and be depressed. Now, this is a spectacular oversimplification that is simply not true in many, many cases. It may affect those things, but whether low dopamine will not lead to those things. It may be consistent with them, but it will not lead to them. They depend on a million different things. She also ignores that dopamine is involved in all kinds of things. Dopamine levels rise not just when you're aroused sexually. They arise when you have intense interest of anything, when you are anticipating with pleasure a meal, the next song you're going to listen to, walking downtown, any anticipation of pleasure. Dopamine is, it's not so much about feeling pleasure as it is anticipating pleasure and actually anticipating change. It's sort of a salience marker. This whole dopamine processing system. Dopamine does other stuff, but in reward, its role is to sort of cue you in and teach you to anticipate something and then have you anticipate it. Now, the killer here is that this goes across the board, so that while sexual desire and pleasure will have an effect on your dopamine levels and be driven partly by them in that particular situation, all kinds of other scenarios in life also raise them. So this is the problem with one major huge conclusion she draws, which is that if a woman is sexually frustrated or not fulfilled, that it will sort of destroy her as a person. It will keep her from being a whole person in other realms because she overemphasizes immensely the importance, she can sort of grants a singular role to sexuality and sexual desire and satisfaction in keeping dopamine levels up. So the whole thing's oversimplified to start with, her picture of how dopamine works. And the big thing is she makes it all about sexual response. Now, she could have saved herself some trouble if she'd gone in as Maya Solovitz, who writes at Time, had a nice review of the science involved here. And she did what Naomi Wolf maybe should have done early in her going, which was to call or perhaps write Larry Young. He's a big researcher in this whole area in neuroendocrinology of sexual and social bonding. And as he put it to Maya, he said, dopamine is involved in reward and motivation for everything we do in life, whether we're eating food, drinking good wine, or interacting with kids and family. That's the end of that quote. But she makes it sound like it's all about sex. And as he puts it, Young, taking one type of pleasure away is not going to change all the other aspects of your life like that. And also points out that dopamine is released under stressful conditions and so on. So it's not about pleasure. It's about salience and the anticipation of events of consequence, essentially. And sexuality is only one of many things that both is driven by and affects dopamine levels.
So how did this happen? Like, did she misinterpret a study or two? Is that the problem?
I don't know what went wrong behind the curtain. I don't know. We all get stuff wrong sometimes. She stayed wrong as she looked into this. And the only thing I can think of is that early on, she got very excited that at what appeared to be a picture of all this, the picture that she ended up describing, and how it all seemed to come together, and then either didn't come across, didn't seek out, or managed to discount or ignore evidence to the contrary. I mean, it's confirmation bias, right? A big thing in science where you are hoping will be true, you are very open to evidence of that sort and tend to discount evidence to the contrary. And I think that happened here, or she, it's hard to figure out how you would do a lot of reporting on this and do kind of a serious read of the literature and come up with these things. You wouldn't have to call very many dopamine experts before they laid down the corrective that Larry Young did.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm here with author and Wired.com writer David Dobbs. We'll be back to talk more about the neurobiology in Naomi Wolf's book Vagina, and of course the controversy around it, after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm here with David Dobbs, science writer at Wired.com, who recently took issue with the use of neurobiology in the book Vagina by Naomi Wolf. Now, one of the problematic areas in the book is Wolf's use of Jim Fausse's work. You mentioned him, his work on dopamine. Now, he is, as a proper researcher, and as you said, a Concordia University psychologist and neurobiologist. And you initially, I believe it was in your first post, you took issue with Wolf's interpretation of his work. But as it turns out, he might actually agree with her, sort of. Can you give us some background there?
Yeah, that was a bit strange. I mean, I was responding to her book. I did not know his work, which isn't to say he's really obscure. I wouldn't have come across it in the stuff I'm writing about lately. So, you know, that happens. And she quoted him, and I left, you know, when I brought him up in my first long post about it, I said I was worried about the way she drew on her sources, that at that point it was kind of strange. I was torn on whether to even write about the book at that point, because the book was not out yet, but it was getting reviewed all over the place. She was talking about it all over the place, and I thought, well, what am I going to do? So I went to the website, and lo and behold, a good amount of the, what proved to be a fair amount of the stuff on these neurotransmitters was at the website. And particularly one of the first parts where she gets into the whole business about dopamine. So I was going on that, and I was trying to be careful and cut her the benefit of the doubt, although what I saw was horrifying. And there was references to Dr. Fausse's work. She had defended herself by saying she really had a lot of literature in there, and she talked to a lot of researchers. The first researcher she referred to, and she referred to this woman as a dopamine researcher, a couple of Googles showed that this woman was not what we generally think of as a researcher. She did research, but she's not a scientific researcher. She's a former corporate lawyer who writes sort of pop sci stuff a lot about dopamine. So that was the first researcher. The next, Jim Fausse, I found him. He's legitimate, you know, at a real university. So I was cutting him the benefit of the doubt and said that perhaps he doesn't go with her on these, and she's sort of overdoing it with his work. But that proved illusory. And what happened was, a few days later, he jumped into the fray. The Wolf's publicist sent my editor at Wired Science a long piece that he had written, and we got a note from Wolf saying that they really hoped to run it at Wired. It hadn't been offered to anyone else. My editor gave it to me. I decided, well, I'm going to write a response to this. And while we were still doing all that, it showed up at Huffington Post. So I guess maybe they got impatient because a whole day went by. So I decided, well, I'll have to deal with this a little more directly. Now, his rebuttal, his was a defense of Wolf, and he laid out an argument that, in fact, some of the points I made, and also Zoe Heller, he addressed two reviews, Zoe Heller's and the New York Review of Books, which was wonderful, and the one I wrote at Wired, because they're the ones that hit the science the most. And he took some, made some objections to things I said, and basically made an argument that actually this is the picture that the science is showing of the role of dopamine in sexual response. And he said it with quite a bit of certainty in his HuffPo post. So at that point, I decided, well, maybe the most direct, he also misrepresented in several ways kind of where I was coming from. So I decided, well, I'm not going to kind of go point by point, or I'm going to do better than go point by point. I put his whole post at my blog on Wired and annotated it point by point, like with little bracketed inserts in the running through the piece.
And we will actually link to that as well.
Which is kind of a little bit tedious, I think, but I think it was called for in this case. And what troubled me was that both my argument was and remains, this science is too ambiguous, it's too conflicted, the jury is out on how this stuff works in terms of drawing this powerful and simplistic conclusion about how dopamine drives its role in sexual response and how central it is, the strength of the link between dopamine and that it's all about sexual response as opposed to, and it gets sort of hijacked by sexual response, just because that's the way the body works, right? Something's around, a mechanism is around, and a new need draws on it. And I was a little astonished to see a scientist trying to argue, no, it is simpler than this. But he did, and what was so I was, you know, briefly a little bit frightened that, well, maybe it really is as simple as he said. But just really a couple of PubMed searches showed not that. Again and again, the major reviews done in the last 5 years of this exact field, like if you Google dopamine female sexuality, you get abstracts and papers where the conclusions part essentially say, too vague to call. We don't understand this. And that was, I was taken aback that Faust would come to her defense that stridently when the literature, it's just clear that it's not as simple as Wolf, and apparently he seemed to think it is.
And that's interesting because you wouldn't expect that, but he even commented in the comment section of your post, continuing that conversation. So he obviously has a vested interest in this. But one of the things that I found was so interesting is that he actually almost apologized for Wolf. He implied that maybe she got stuff wrong-ish, but it was in pursuit of a broader goal, and so it was therefore okay.
Right. No, he did. You that was in there. He was trying to acknowledge, you know, without being rude to her, acknowledge that maybe she didn't get everything quite right, which, you know, if that was the case, if there are a few things she didn't get quite right, I wouldn't have had a problem, you know, or small problems. But that two things. One, certainly a writer should get a little bit of leeway. And at the same time, making the argument, but at any rate, she started a robust discussion about this, and that's always good. Well, two things. Leeway, okay. Everybody gets a little slack. People get a little poetic license. People, you know, writers especially recognize that, you know, you are paraphrasing the science, you're paraphrasing reality, so things have to be a little bit simpler so people can understand them. But simplifying and getting it just dead wrong are two different things. I was surprised he would defend her, you know, just define sort of, or portray just, she's a wrong way. She's like sailing in the wrong direction. There's nothing of leeway here. And then to make the argument at the same time, well, even if she gets it wrong, at least she's starting a good discussion.
I wish that worked for everything.
Don't we? Don't. Because if you start the discussion by claiming a bunch of science that is just wrong, a lot of people won't hear the flap, or they ignore. And you can see this at the Huffington Post, for instance, where she has written since then. There's a lot of people that are all in on this, and they're with her all the way. And I'm fine with if they're with her about her sentiments or her vision of female sexuality. I don't agree with that vision. But if somebody wants to go with that, that's their thing. But that they sign up and accept the science as being accurate is really troubling to me, because it just speaks to people's, you know, that they want to, they'll fit the science to what they want to see. It's not a healthy thing to see.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking to David Dobbs, writer at Wired.com. We are discussing the neurobiology of the vagina, according to Naomi Wolf. We have a question from Camilla.
How could the book have been written in a responsible way? How would she have had to change it?
There's one easy answer, which is to not go all in on her vision of, well, a couple of things. One, take a little time and get the neuroscience right. Describe the role of these neurotransmitters accurately. Some of her argument would remain, right? She wants to make it global. She wants to make these things simple. She wants to make them the key to female sexuality, consciousness, and identity. It's a lot to ask of a neurotransmitter. So if she could get that right, she could curb her ambitions a bit. It doesn't seem to really be in her character. And she could, most important, not make global statements. I think the thing that bothers me as someone who likes to see accuracy in science, and that I know bothers a lot of women, is that she portrays this vision of female sexuality as the one that applies to almost all women. And I think that's why you have to push the science. If you are determined to make that argument, then, and you want to have it scientific, as is the trend these days, then it leads you down the path she went. So I think, in other words, if this were about, here's what happened to me, here was my path back to a different acceptance of my sexuality, it's not for everyone, but this worked for me, and it makes me think that maybe everyone could revisit and maybe find a happier place for themselves. This and some better science. And she has a book that I don't think I'd have a huge problem with.
We have a question from Kelly.
Would research into the brains of transgendered people provide any challenge to the conclusions in the book?
Any additional challenge, you mean?
Right.
That's hard to say. I couldn't say, because I wouldn't know what to expect might be different or the same in the sort of neuroendocrinology of sexual response in transgendered people. My suspicion, my feeling is that Wolf has exaggerated not only the overall importance of these neurotransmitters, but that in a few places where I know the science a bit, she seems to be exaggerating the differences in how they work in women and in men. I could be wrong about that. I'm not an expert in this field. But to the degree that she has exaggerated that, then you wouldn't expect to find huge differences in transgender people. We're like two layers of speculation in there.
Nope.
So,
thank you for acknowledging that. This one is from Gravespinner.
Although Naomi Wolf is a Rhodes Scholar, most of the reviews agree with David. Some refer to her consultation with her tantric healer, which seems to raise questions about her scientific integrity. Can this book be considered a follow-up to her previous pop science works?
I get to dodge that one because I have not read her previous pop science works. One of the reviews, I lose track. There's so many scathing reviews. One of the reviews said no novelist could think of a better parody of her entire career than this book provides. So I think that makes the answer to that listener's question yes, but in the way she would want.
So I guess how can writers avoid these kind of problems? Because as we said, Faust seemed like he was encouraging her interpretations. You know, she's not a neuroscientist, so how is she supposed to know? Especially when someone's implying that she's right.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, in a way, that is not really hard. You go and you talk to other researchers in the field. You talk to the ones on the margins, and you talk to the ones who everyone acknowledges are the leading researchers. And yeah, as I said before, had she done that, you know, she would have soon talked to Larry Young or someone who gave the same message, who had the same credibility, experience, research depth, and knowledge as Larry Young, who would tell her something very much different. I mean, the number of scientists who have beaten this thing over the head is just unbelievable. It's not hard to find someone who sees the science here radically differently than Jim Faust. And that suggests the answer. Makes it more false.
So then do books like this actually hurt the field of neurobiology, do you think?
I mean, yes and no. There'll be a lot of people. There are a lot of people who are reading this book and accepting this science as the way it is. And that could hurt the field for a little while, until another book comes along until the readers either forget or they come across another book that changes their mind. There's always going to be bad science out there and bad writing about it will go on. I don't think it hurts the field that much. I think it hurts the public perception of the field.
Well, I can tell you it's not doing much for feminism either.
No.
David, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me on.
You can find David Dobbs at Neuron Culture on Wired.com or at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with genetics researcher Michael White to talk about the results and the reporting of the ENCODE Genomics Project. Stay tuned.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking at the science and pseudoscience that affects the healthcare decisions parents make for their children and women make for themselves. We're joined by Allison Haygood and Stacey Herlihy to talk about their book, Your Baby's Best Shot, Why Vaccines Are Safe and Save Lives. And we're joined by SkepChick.org founder Rebecca Watson to talk about pseudoscience that's targeted and marketed specifically at women. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at SkepticallySpeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Michael White. Michael is a scientist in the Department of Genetics and the Center for Genome Sciences and Systems Biology at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. He studies the way that cells use the information in the genome to regulate their genes. He's also a longtime science blogger and the co-founder of the online science pub, The Finchin Pea, where he writes about science and books, especially science fiction. Very nice to have you here, Michael.
Thanks very much, Desiree, for having me on the show.
Now, you're here to talk about a new study on the human genome, one that's made a significant amount of noise in the last couple of weeks. Unfortunately, from your perspective, most of the actual science was obscured by a lot of hype. So I want to get a sense of what exactly we're supposed to be learning here. What is ENCODE?
ENCODE is essentially a successor to the Human Genome Project. About 10 years ago, the Human Genome Project, which was a scientific consortium to sequence the human genome, about 10 years ago, they released the sequence, the text of our genome, as you will. But that text is basically impossible to read without having an interpretive guide of biochemical landmarks, sort of telling you what's going on where in the genome. So ENCODE, which stands for the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, was a consortium that was set up in order to determine those biochemical landmarks in the genome to help us read the genome, help us interpret what's going on where in the genome and what is the relationship between our actual DNA sequence and what happens in the cell and what happens to make us healthy and to make us sick.
So basically, it was like a big translation dictionary.
Pretty much, yeah. It was a dictionary and an encyclopedia in both ways. So basically, they measured all of these biochemical landmarks. They measured, for example, where regulatory proteins in the genome, which these are proteins that bind to DNA and turn genes on and off. So that's very important. You can't develop properly or stay healthy without turning genes on and off at the right time. So they were measuring where those regulatory proteins were binding. DNA is often wrapped up very tightly when it's not being used, and then when it's being used, it's unwrapped and it's opened up so that your regulatory proteins can bind. So the ENCODE scientists were finding out where DNA tends to be unwrapped in your nerve cells or in your liver cells or in other types of cells, and then where it's wrapped up tightly. And there are dozens, actually hundreds of different biochemical landmarks like that that help us, that give us clues about what's going on in the genome.
So this was a massive project, correct?
Very large project. It's been going on at least 5 years, I believe. Nearly $300 million in grant money. More than 400 researchers at a wide variety of institutions in multiple countries. And they produced more than 1,000 data sets that scientists like me now get to play around with and get to dig into and find interesting things to help us develop our ideas.
Now, one would assume that the results from a project of that magnitude would naturally cause some anticipation.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. It's a lot of scientists. And the publication of the results was coordinated so that they would take a lot of slots at top-tier journals. So it was at the same time, 30 papers published at once the other week. So it was really primed to make a big splash. And a lot of people were interested to see what was coming out. So possibly from the public's point of view, there was a great big rollout. For some of us who work in genome biology, we've been seeing some of these results come out in dribs and drabs over the years. We've been hearing people talk at conferences and things like that. So actually, the extravaganza associated with the publication was maybe a little more surprising to me than... and the actual results.
Well, that's what I was wondering, because unfortunately the story that's been crafted around the results is, and I'm just going to read this, as you put it, a massive science reporting fail on a large scale. In the story you wrote for the Huffington Post, you focused on the idea that ENCODE has debunked the whole concept of junk DNA. So maybe before we talk about why that's wrong, what is junk DNA?
Junk DNA... well, it seems to have two different definitions. One is the definition that was used somewhat casually by scientists from the 70s up until today. And then there's the other definition, which I will say is the wrong definition that's been used in the media. But the idea of junk DNA came up when scientists realized that our genomes are quite big. Genomes of not just humans, but mammals, even other organisms, plants, reptiles, they have very big genomes, way more than we think we actually need to code for all of our genes, to code for our proteins. And so there was good evidence, there were good reasons to believe that a lot of that genome was non-functional, that it really wasn't coding for genes and it wasn't actually doing anything useful for the cell. And so the term junk DNA was coined, sort of as a casual way of referring to non-functional DNA. And of course, junk DNA is just a very vague term, actually, and that's one reason why some people don't like it, because it implies, and this was picked up by the media, that, well, there's all this DNA, we don't know what it does, so we're just going to dismiss it and call it junk. But that's not what happened at all. Scientists have been very interested in that portion of the genome that's been labeled junk, and they labeled it junk or non-functional DNA, not because of what we didn't know about it, but rather because of what we did know. For example, we know much of that junk DNA is made up of genomic parasites. So your genome, far from being the control panel with millions of genetic switches and blinking lights and all that the media story suggested, is actually more like a jungle or an ecosystem. It's seething with parasites and all sorts of elements that are doing their own thing. And one important class of genomic elements are called transposable elements, and they have the ability to copy themselves throughout the cell. So basically, their purpose for existence is to replicate themselves. not to do anything useful for you. And scientists were aware of this in the 70s and 80s, and they've studied these transposable elements quite intensively and fruitfully for going on 30 years now. And sometimes what we've labeled junk, sometimes or this non-functional DNA, gets recruited to do something useful, but most of the time the reason it's there is because it's able to get itself into the next generation. It's able to make copies of itself. And basically it's there because it can be there.
Well, have the ENCODE results raised any serious doubts about that idea?
I would say no, they haven't. I would say that very strongly, for several reasons. So one is, so a lot of this DNA that we've labeled junk, a lot of these transposable elements and other parts of DNA that we might consider non-functional, a lot of those elements we expect in some ways, in many ways, to have the same biochemical landmarks as functional DNA. So what ENCODE did was they measured, when they went through and they measured these different biochemical landmarks, where regulatory proteins bind, where your chromatin is wrapped up. Well, those landmarks show up in these transposable elements as well because they use the same biochemistry that the rest of the cell uses to spread themselves throughout the genome. There's another reason that we expect biochemical landmarks that ENCODE was measuring to show up in non-functional regions of the genome, and that is the way proteins find their way around DNA, around the genome, is actually quite noisy. So let's take a regulatory protein that binds to DNA and switches a gene on or switches it off. What it does is it recognizes a very short sequence in the DNA, maybe six or seven bases. And so, you know, one way of thinking how genome, the problem that regulatory proteins face when they're finding their way around the genome is if you came up to me in St. Louis and said, hey, I have a message for you to deliver to Catherine. Can you deliver it to Catherine? Well, there are a lot of Catherines in St. Louis, and you can spell Catherine in multiple different ways. So I really have no idea which Catherine you're talking about. And if I try to deliver a message to Catherine, I'm bound to bump into the wrong one. So that's actually an interesting question that scientists like myself are studying. How do regulatory proteins find their way around the genome? And certainly what happens some of the time is they find the wrong target, the wrong place in the DNA. And so you'll find biochemical landmarks just by chance, just by accident, in different places of the genome.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, and I'm talking to Michael White. Michael is an instructor in the Department of Genetics and the Center for Genome Sciences and Systems Biology at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. We're talking about the science behind the ENCODE Genomics Project and how little of that science made it unscathed into the reporting on the story. So how badly was the reporting on this story?
Well, so if you read any of the reporting on the story, the story that you were fed was that junk DNA has been debunked. So, for example, the New York Times headline said, "Far from junk, DNA dark matter proves crucial to health." Or the Washington Post said things like, "Junk DNA debunked by new analysis of the human genome." Even the journal Science, you know, where some of this ENCODE material was published, had a news article that said, "ENCODE Project writes eulogy for junk DNA." So if you read the headlines and you sort of read the initial part of all of the articles, the story you got was this. And this story is very wrong. The story you got was this. Scientists, back when they realized that the classic protein-coding genes made up only a tiny fraction of the genome, less than 2%, they then decided, in a fit of arrogance or out of their ignorance of what else was going on, to just dismiss the rest of the genome as junk. So for 30 years, biologists have supposedly believed that the rest of the genome is worthless, it's not interesting, it's not worth studying, but here comes ENCODE. And they look for these biochemical landmarks in the genome, and lo and behold, the genome is packed with function. That was pretty much the main story that you got out of most of these articles, and that story is just wrong. It gets the science wrong, as we talked about a few minutes ago. It gets the science that was done in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, everything before the Human Genome Project. It gets the actual significance of the ENCODE results wrong. I mean, the interesting thing about the ENCODE results is not that they supposedly debunked junk DNA, but they provided all this. They provided this encyclopedia, the Encyclopedia of the Genome. They provided a great resource that's going to facilitate scientific work for years to come. And the other reason why these stories were horribly wrong is that they misrepresented the scientific process. Basically, the scientific process that you get from these stories is that scientists, when they didn't know about something, they dismiss it. They build theories based on their dismissal of something they don't know anything about. And then suddenly somebody comes along and proves that everything we thought we knew is just wrong, wrong, wrong. And it makes for a sensational story, but that's generally not how science works.
And do you feel that that's kind of widespread?
Yeah, I think it's
perhaps
it's an easy narrative to latch onto, right? You can have a great newspaper headline when you say, "Ah, breakthrough! Everything that we thought before was just wrong." Scientists being wrong makes a great story, right? Sometimes they think too much of themselves. They're too much. We like to poke fun at our authorities, and in fact, scientists are wrong a lot. And individual scientists who aren't wrong on a regular basis probably aren't generating enough new ideas because we're wrong a lot. But it's generally not true that there is sort of a widely established consensus that is just suddenly overturned and everything we believed for 20 years was completely wrong based on one set of experiments.
I think that that's really interesting, the idea of a conflict between the old and new science. Why is that so compelling to people? Is it just the authority issue?
Well, maybe it helps people to think that we're making progress. Incremental progress can be boring, right? One example that crops up over and over again in the media is progress on curing and diagnosing cancer. Mm-hmm. So we all like to hear headlines about how we're going to find the silver bullet to cure cancer. There's going to be a eureka moment and suddenly everything's going to be different. But actually what's been going on for the past 20 or 30 years is that we're making very good progress. It's a little more incremental. It's a little less sensational. But in fact, we've really improved greatly in our ability to discover cancer, to diagnose it, and yes, to treat many types of cancer. But that's a much less sensational story.
Well, it seems like there's a compromise between the narrative and the accuracy. I'm going to try and give them the benefit of the doubt, but I assume what they're trying to do is making it, them being the journalists, they're trying to make it interesting to the public.
I sympathize with them because sometimes it's hard to make science exciting, and kudos to them for doing that. But I think there are ways you can make things about ENCODE exciting without putting up this narrative that everything scientists thought for 30 years. In fact, the Washington Post basically said what ENCODE found was radically at odds with what biologists have believed for three decades. They didn't really need to say anything like that. I think it's pretty amazing to come up with the encyclopedia of your genome. That to me sounds pretty exciting.
Well, I do want to wrap up by pointing out that you're not just pinning all this on the reporters. You, in your posts, you actually lay a lot of blame on the scientists who are quoted in these stories. So what kinds of things are the scientists saying that you object to?
Yeah, well, so many of these scientists have said similar things, that they have said junk DNA has been debunked, for example. There are scientists who will make claims that eventually we're going to discover that all of the human genome is functional. When that is actually from an evolutionary and even a biochemical perspective, just outrageous. So one thing to know about biology, and especially genome biology, is that it's a great mix. It's very interdisciplinary. We've been bringing in great people from computer science, from physics, from engineering, and it all comes into this great heady mix where everybody's contributing their unique skills. But part of the problem is many of those people come in and haven't really read anything in genome biology that was published before the human genome sequence. And so, or that, for example, they haven't spent much time actually learning evolutionary biology, which tells us a lot about why our genome is the way it is. And so you get a bunch of people from very different backgrounds who, you know, scientists are like, maybe like journalists, we like to sensationalize our work as well. certainly not just the journalists. And so we will say things to put our findings in the most exciting possible light. And scientists being wrong is not just a good story for the public, it's a good story for other scientists too.
Right. So are these sorts of overbroad, let's say, claims, would they be shot down pretty fast if they were presented to other genetics professionals?
Yeah, I think so. I read statements in the news reports by code scientists that I don't think would ever they would ever make or they would ever make with impunity at the scientific conferences that I go to. I think scientists should sometimes they're much more careful in what they say before their peers than what they say before the public, because they think maybe it's a more casual situation. We have to make things more interesting. But we need to be very careful about what we say to the public as well, just as careful as what we say to each other in conferences.
So is it getting to the point where readers, people like me, lay people, have to go looking for people like you to check out every science story we find? Because that's not fair, honestly.
It's really not fair. That's definitely not fair. There's a lot of good science journalism out there. Most science journalists really try to get the story right. I think sometimes when there's a big project like ENCODE that's going to make a big splash, and there are many papers, many scientists saying different things about it, it can definitely be difficult to get the story right. And so often, if there's a large, complex story, what you'll do when you're writing about the science is latch on to the simplest narrative. And so in that case, it was junk DNA is debunked in the case of ENCODE. But most of the time, I think there's a lot of good science reporting out there. But then we also have great science blogs out there. So if you want to see what's really going on, you can always find go see what the scientists on the blogs are saying, because we really have some great scientists who are out there blogging about these issues.
I know. That's why I have you all come on the show.
Give us a chance to repeat our rants.
I was calling it Set the Record Straight, but whichever you'd like. Michael, thank you very much for giving us the non-exploding with hype version of this story.
Thanks for giving me a chance to talk about it.
You'll find a link to Michael's writing at The Finch and Pea on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, please do click the links to Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, where you can keep up with show news, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the program, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. Here at Skeptically Speaking, we like science books. A lot. If you like science books and you're looking for help expanding your reading list, this is your lucky day. We now have a way for you to learn more about the books we've featured since we went on the air. Rochelle Saunders, regular guest host and voracious reader, has signed us up for Goodreads, the giant social site for book lovers. She's added every book we'd recommend, from authors that we've interviewed or titles suggested by our guests. They're all there. Books on topics ranging from genetics to neuroscience, sexuality to information security. If we've enjoyed it here, you can check it out at home. And Rochelle will be updating the list every time we talk about a new book on the show. So if you want to read along with us, or the science shelves in your library just need some serious love, look for Skeptically Speaking at goodreads.com. If you're already a member, or you sign up for an account, you can compare your bookshelf to ours and share your thoughts about the books that we've posted. You'll find a link to our Goodreads profile on the contact page of our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced and distributed by Suburban Panic Media. Our studio assistants are Helen Cavillion and Chelsea Butler. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician. The show is edited by K.O. Myers.
Our theme song was written and recorded by AOK. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.